Hello and welcome to this first podcast brought to you by Juniata College in the Department of Religious Studies. I'm your host, Don Braxton. I'm a professor of religious studies here at the college. Our subject for this first inaugural podcast is Loyal Rue. He is a professor of philosophy and religion at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Loyal was asked to present on his book, Religion is Not About God, a 2005 publication by Rutgers University Press. The context for the talk was the Society of Christian Ethics, which meets annually. This particular meeting was in Phoenix, Arizona. It took place on January 8th. The group to whom he presented was the group Environmental Theology and Ethics Interest Group, a assembly of professional theologians and ethicists who work largely in the Christian tradition. The topic he was asked to address was eco-crisis and the future of religion. Let's get right into the talk.
Mentally relevant part of the argument by just reading a few carefully selected passages. And it should give you a fair understanding of what the book in its entire is about. This is right from the beginning. If religion is not about God, then what on earth is it about? It's about us. It's about manipulating our brains so that we might think, feel, and act in ways that are good for us, both individually and collectively. Religious traditions work like the bow of a violin, playing on the strings of human nature to produce harmonious relations between individuals and their social and physical environment. Religions have always been about this business of adaptation, and they will always remain so. This is not to say, however, that any particular religious tradition will remain adaptive. Religions sometimes outlive their adaptive utility and occasionally become positive threats to human survival. This book comes in three parts. The argument of part one is that a universal human nature exists, and that it can be known by examining our evolutionary story, especially the evolution of behavior. And the argument continues by showing how cognitive and emotional systems work together and how they are conditioned by cultural influences. And part one ends with a chapter on the nature of religion, which argues that religious traditions are best understood in terms of their powers to nurture our cognitive and emotional systems toward the achievement of personal and social well-being. This now comes from part three. Sometimes dire consequences may be prevented precisely because they are predicted. I mention dire consequences because my own expectations about the future are rather pessimistic. I believe that we are presently faced with the most threatening circumstances of our entire history as a species. Unsustainable patterns of human population and material consumption are now stressing natural and social systems near the point of no return. We are not living in harmony with reality. And the clearest measure of our folly is that the life support systems of the Earth are already in a state of serious decline. Further, I believe that these problems come at a time when our religious traditions are losing their powers to command an adaptive response. It is not unlikely in the course of the present century that we will overshoot the carrying capacity of our planet, and the consequences of doing so will be grim. There may be little chance that we will go extinct in the process of collapse, but in the near term, we may expect to see chaos, misery, and death on a scale we can scarcely imagine. Our question has been whether the world's received traditions possess the influence and the will to lead a morally relevant response to the global environmental crisis. The potential is clearly present, and events like the Harvard series on religion and ecology offer some encouragement. But in my judgment, a timely and effective response is not likely. The requisite changes are too radical. The sacrifices are too deep. The time is too brief, the value of nature is too peripheral, and the forces of resistance internal to these traditions are too great. So what does that mean? It means that the process of correcting our ecological footprint deficit will not be one of our choosing. There are no good reasons to believe that we might be moved in sufficient numbers to make the necessary sacrifices before they are forced upon us. The specific details of a doomsday event are anyone's guess, but it's likely that the general consequences would tend to be similar in most scenarios. Most generally, the underlying conditions for personal wholeness and social coherence would begin to collapse. Supplies of vital resources diminish, and competition for them grows increasingly ugly and dangerous. Important industries begin to falter and fold. Unemployment skyrockets. Homelessness increases. Individuals become progressively more fearful, anxious, suspicious, uncooperative, devious, and desperate. Inflation soars, gangs coalesce, crime becomes rampant, raids on hoarders are commonplace, vigilante groups organize, public services decline, cities grow unmanageable and squalid, utilities become undependable, riots, looting, and fires ravage whole cities, schools close, nothing gets repaired, water and food become increasingly scarce and putrid, diseases spread, healthcare systems buckle, sickness and death at every hand. Armed conflicts flare up in city streets, refugees, scavengers, and shanty towns everywhere. Border incidents escalate into minor wars, and the lamps of civilization go dark. That's a very pessimistic view of the future. And that pessimistic view is based really on four things. One, it's based in part on a certain understanding of human nature. It's also based in part on a certain understanding of religious traditions and how they work to nurture human nature. It's also based on a certain understanding of the environmental problems that we face and the urgency of those problems. And then finally, it's based on a judgment about the likelihood that our religious traditions can achieve a sort of adaptive response, can lead an adaptive response in time to avert the pattern of overshoot and collapse into a dark age. So I can say something about each of those, the human nature part, the how religions function part. I don't think I'll say anything about the environmental problems because you know about those. But I might say something also about the reason why I don't think religious traditions can pull us out of this one. On human nature, I think the most relevant thing to say is that in the course of evolution, humans emerged characterized by a wide range of behavior mediation systems. And I was going to show some overhead things, but I can just pass this around. You can see where I was going with that. We behave in the way we do because our behavior is mediated by certain stable systems that produce behavior. These systems are all teleonomic systems. That is to say, they produce goal-directed behavior. And the trick of being a human being is to organize these things so that the goals have a certain hierarchy, a certain priority. And because you can't do everything at once, these things have to be organized. And religious traditions help us to organize these systems. The goals inherent in these behavior mediation systems are basically our values. It's just another way of talking about values. Human beings are goal-oriented, goal-seeking beings, teleonomic beings, and these systems are all working as we try to negotiate a livelihood on the planet. religious traditions are designed to influence these behavior mediation systems. There isn't much that a religious tradition can do to influence molecular systems or reflex systems or even perceptual systems. So religious traditions really focus on trying to influence the operation of these higher systems, because these systems are open to manipulation by symbolic means. And so religious traditions are into the business of helping us to organize our goal hierarchies. So the question is, how do they do that? They do it by presenting us with a story. Religious traditions are, in my judgment, all story traditions. And I have this little schema that suggests that, that basically is the structure of a religious tradition. I take the view that we can generalize on religious traditions, and they all, as I read it, more or less reflect that structure. At the very core of a religious tradition is a story, and the story is an integration of cosmological ideas and moral ideas. These things are tied together, integrated, they're confused in the course of the story. And that gives us a single vocabulary for talking about how things are in the world, that is facts, and which things matter, that is values. Facts and values are confused, and so that we have a single vocabulary that provides both an ultimate explanation for all facts and, at the same time, an ultimate justification for all values. So that religious traditions are really naturalistic fallacy violating traditions. And the deep rationale for that is that this is what brains do, actually. I mean, every good brain has to do a number of things. It has to somehow represent how things are in the world, what's going on out there, has to represent that internally. It also has to represent how things are going on inside the skin. And so our brains have these neural maps of the whole body and what's going on in the body. So we have an encoding, neural encoding of the world outside, representation of how things are going on the inside, and the brain also has to bring those together and assess the implications of what's going on outside for what's going on inside. Bring them together and work out some sort of adaptive response. That's, in a way, what I see religious traditions doing, giving us a representation of how things are, which things matter, and confusing those, putting those together into a unified vocabulary, which gives us a justification and explanation at the same time. And what does that, what enables religious traditions to do that, is a root metaphor. The metaphor of God as person, for example, is a metaphor that enables us to confuse facts and values, because this God is the creator of the universe and is the final and ultimate explanation for how everything is. This God is also the author of the moral law and is the final justification for all our values. Those come together in this notion of God as person and give us a unified vocabulary for talking about explanation and justification.
So would you be focused then on Western religions?
Eastern religions have variations on this. The Dharma, for example, is not God as person, but it is a metaphor that enables people in Hindu and Buddhist traditions to talk about facts and values, to integrate them. I think this is the role of the Tao. This is the role of the Logos in early Greek tradition. One metaphor that can explain the rationality of the world and also the rationality of human values. So these are different kinds of metaphors. God as person is one. that metaphor characterizes the Abrahamic tradition. But Dharma, Tao, Logos, these other kinds of metaphors do the same thing, basically. So what you have there in a religious tradition is a story that holds together an integration of ideas about how things are, which things matter, a cosmology and a morality sort of locked together or welded together by these root metaphors.
And would you say we have internally within a religion, let alone conflicts among religions, maybe conflictive adaptation? For example, you have a liberation theology in Christianity, which does not accept the way things are in the hierarchical system that's been part of the Christian churches. You could find similar things. Mark Ellis did a Jewish theology of liberation presentation last night.
So, right.
So you have conflicts internally within a community. Then it raises the questions of who defines the cosmological ideas and also the moral values and how they...
Right. Well, they have to be, they have to be clarified. They have to be interpreted. That's why on the outside... There are what I'm calling ancillary strategies. These are strategies which work to keep the myth intact, to give a definition, and also to transmit it. And one of those ancillary strategies is what I've called the intellectual strategy. And the intellectual strategy is that's basically the people that are in charge of interpreting the myth. And defending the myth and clarifying the myth. This is where theology and ethics happen. Theology is more specialized on explaining and clarifying the cosmological ideas, but ethics is more interested in explaining and interpreting and defending the moral ideas. But every religious tradition, more or less, will have this intellectual dimension, which interprets, clarifies, and defends. Some traditions are stronger in that strategy than others, but they all have some kind of explanation, some kind of...
You're listening to a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religious Studies at Juniata College. Our speaker is Loyal Rue. Let's return now to Loyal's talk, where he addresses the topic of ancillary strategies. Strategies religions use to reinforce the truth claim of the myths at the heart of their traditions.
But the intellectual part, which is theology and ethics, is only one of the strategies required to keep a mythic tradition intact. Another is the institutional element. Of course, every religious tradition has to transmit itself. It has to have some kind of organization. Somebody has to decide polity and what sorts of symbols are going to be accepted as reflecting the myth and so on. So the institutional part is another aspect. There is the aesthetic part, which is very important in developing symbols. I think a person probably could make an argument that Christianity never really got itself going until it developed an art. So every tradition has art, literature, drama, music, all of these things that help to express, to give objective form to the central story. There's also the experiential aspect. Now, every religious tradition I've looked at tries to find ways to get individuals to validate the myth, the story, in subjective terms. So that if, for example, if you've talked to God this morning and then came to a meeting like this and I were to give you five or six arguments against the existence of God, you wouldn't even hear them, right? Because you know better. You have this sort of firsthand experience. And so every religious tradition, more or less, some are more mystical than others, but they all are open to these subjective moving experiences that can give personal validation to the myth. That enables the individual to take ownership of the story. So there's the intellectual part, there's the institutional part, there's the aesthetic part, there is the experiential part, And then there's the ritual part, which is an attempt to dramatize, to live out the myth. And every religious tradition, of course, has a variety of rituals that it performs. And when the ritual's performed, one way of looking at it is that the universal story and the particular individual story are somehow mapped onto one another, and so that when we celebrate the Mass, for example, I mean, I can relate to that because I have defeats in my own life. I have crucifixions and resurrections in my own life, and that's the pattern of crucifixion and resurrection really does reflect something deep within my own life, and so pattern of my life maps onto the pattern of the universal story, and that enables some kind of ownership of the story. So the idea is that these various strategies are all strategies that keep the myth shaped, keep the myth vital, and keep the myth transformed from one generation to another. And when these strategies are doing their work properly, when they're effective, they will organize these goal hierarchies so that the idea is for the values that are embedded in the myth to become my values. And the process is one of transformation, that is a process by which I download my own agenda. I offload my own agenda, I delete my own agenda, and I download God's agenda, so that the old Adam, my agenda, my self-interests, are pushed out, and God's agenda becomes my agenda. Now, if that happens across a whole society, then you have people that have a common view of how things are, a common view of which things matter, and a common set of goals, priorities, and are able then to act in concert. And when those strategies are working effectively, they will create what I call an overlap of self-interest, so that I will, it is in my interest, because I've linked my self-esteem to serving God, it is in my interest to serve God. And so I get a sort of self-esteem bump from serving God. But if I'm serving God, I'm also serving others. And so it creates an overlap of self-interest, which is critical for the achievement of the only two things that really matter to human beings, and that is personal wholeness and social coherence. Everything is okay in here, orderly, at equilibrium, and if everything out there is orderly, and at equilibrium, harmonious, that's what we want. That's how, in fact, human beings flourish. They flourish by achieving simultaneously personal wholeness and social coherence. That's our best bet at survival. So that's the way religious traditions work to nourish or to nurture human beings and to restructure goal hierarchy.
You're listening to a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religious Studies at Juniata College. Our speaker is Loyal Rue. Loyal has just completed his overview of his general theory of religion, and he turns to his final question: can religion address the most vital environmental concerns we face today? Let's return to the podcast.
So now there is the question of environmental problems, and I won't say anything more about that because I think we all you wouldn't be here probably if you weren't familiar with what the environmental problems are that are facing us. But we're into a pattern of overshoot and collapse, and the question is: can religious traditions, which specialize in transforming people's goal hierarchies, transforming people's behavior mediation system, can these religious traditions pull it off? Can they pull us out of this? Can they reverse this pattern of overshoot and collapse? And I don't think they can. There are a couple of reasons for that judgment. One is that I think the realism that people have about the story tradition that they live in is flagging. And if people are not realist about the root metaphor in their tradition, then the story isn't going to have the power to transform their goal hierarchies. Just a sort of crude illustration. Jim, if I told you that you should not move, just freeze, don't even breathe, because right behind you there's a hungry tiger. Okay? Now, you're not emotionally moved by that, because you think I'm putting you on. I'm just using this as an illustration, and you're not a realist about that tiger behind you. But if you were a realist about that tiger behind you, you'd be scared as hell. Your emotional systems would be activated. Now, if people are not realists about God as person, then that root metaphor is not going to have the power to engage, to arouse their emotional system. And it's all about organizing and arousing these emotional systems and cognitive systems. That the religions are all about managing that stuff. And if people are not realists about God as person, they aren't going to be moved emotionally by these stories, by the tradition. And I'm suggesting that there is has been a systematic, significant loss of realism with respect to the root metaphor. You see this in liberal theological traditions that come along and say, well, of course, God isn't an old man in the sky. God is the ground of being. Well, the ground of being isn't, I mean, I have yet to see the ground of being provoke the kind of emotional response that Yahweh can produce. I mean, it just doesn't resonate with people. It doesn't have that quality that the root metaphor of God as person has. People are becoming less and less and less realist about God as person, primarily because of the emergence of the scientific worldview. The notion of God as person works well, or has worked well in the past, because the notion of God's intentions or divine providence, person, has been a great metaphor in the deep past for describing how things are in the world. That is, we've used the metaphor of divine intention, God's purposes, to explain reality. So that the person metaphor was the metaphor that explained how the world worked. Now, the person metaphor doesn't work that way. Now, we don't describe nature in terms of person anymore. Now we describe persons in terms of nature. So now somebody can come up and give you a theory of human nature, and there's nothing in there about God. We can describe human nature using scientific terminology. So there's been a massive change here. The explainer has become the explained. And when something like that happens, people become less than realist about about the root metaphor of God as person. And science has, I think, compromised realism about that root metaphor in countless other ways, not just that shift, but in a lot of other ways. And another thing now that has compromised realism about one's tradition, about the root metaphor in one's own tradition, is the awareness of other traditions. Other people have stories. As well as I have a story, and so this leads to a kind of relativizing of all religious stories, and that compromises realism about about the wood metaphor. So there are these developments in contemporary culture that have compromised realism. There's another major development in our culture that affects the power of religious traditions to transform our lives, and that is the emergence of consumerism. It's not that consumerism is a challenge to the root metaphor of Christianity or Judaism, but rather it competes with it. Consumerism is a phenomenon that has emerged, and it almost has mythic qualities of its own. It has emerged as a force that competes with Christianity for the organization of our goal hierarchies. So this consumer culture that we're in affects us in the same way that religion has affected us in the past, that is, by shaping the goals that we're out there to achieve in our life. So, with some combination of science, which challenges the explanatory power of the root metaphor, the awareness of other traditions, which relativizes all traditions, and the competition from consumerism, all of these things come to bear and render religious traditions less effective in shaping our consciousness. And if they don't shape our consciousness, they have less influence in guiding our behavior. And that's why I think they have lost their power to transform human behavior in time to address these environmental problems.
This has been a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religious Studies at Juniata College. Loyal Rue has been our speaker. He is the author of the book Religion is Not About God. You can find his book on Amazon.com. For more information about our program of studies here at Juniata College, additional podcasts of lectures presented at this college, or other projects such as documentaries, please go to the web at www.juniata.edu. Your host has been Donald Braxton, Professor of Religious Studies here at Juniata College. If you have feedback, we're very interested in your responses to this lecture. You can email me at Braxton, Braxton, at juniata.edu. Specific questions, opinions, or suggestions for future podcasts are especially welcome. Again, that email address is Braxton, Braxton, at juniata.edu. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it.